In the decades after World War II ended, thousands of Nazis from Germany, Austria, and other countries fled Europe to avoid investigation for war crimes. Many of them would make use of informal escape networks in places like Italy and Spain. Today, we're going to talk about these rat lines. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not so famous moments in history from all across the globe. Despite popular myth, the escape routes used by fleeing Nazis were not coordinated by states or a formal organization operating in the shadows. But this doesn't mean that they weren't organized and effective, helping even the high-profile figures like Klaus Barbie, Josef Mengele, and Adolf Eichmann escape. So today we're going to explore how they worked, the type of people who've used them, why others helped them escape, including at times important figures within the Catholic Church, and also why some people didn't try to escape at all. And to help me break all of this down is Dr. Waitman Wade Bourne. He's a Holocaust historian. He's an associate professor of history at Northumbria University. He's author of several of my favorite books on this particular subject, the Holocaust and mechanics of it. You may also know him as the host of the Holocaust History Podcast. His most recent book is Between the Wires, the Janowska Camp and the Holocaust in Lviv. Waitman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward.
I think what's probably useful maybe to begin is if we set a scene for listeners about when does the idea that they may need to escape, that there may be some reckoning for those involved in the Holocaust and in war crimes within Germany and beyond start to dawn on people?
It's a good question, and it's important for a couple of reasons. You know, one is that these guys knew that they were doing was wrong. And when I say that, I don't mean necessarily that they thought it was wrong or they thought it was immoral, but they certainly knew that the rest of the world would view it that way. And, you know, even the Nazi state itself was in many ways built upon this idea that they would either have complete and total victory or they would be complete and total destruction. And so it's almost kind of like... Some of these Nazis were putting themselves in the shoes of the victors and saying, well, if we won, we would obviously round up and kill everybody. So obviously that's what the Allies are going to do. So there's very much an understanding for a lot of these folks that they were going to be in some jeopardy. And of course, to anybody that was sort of not a, you know, fanatic with magical thinking, it became pretty clear, you know, by the end of 1942, or so, right, that the war is not going well. And the chances of that supreme unconditional victory for the Nazis are unlikely. But also the Allies have done some things during the war that signal not only a desire to prosecute, but that they're actually beginning to put in place some of the apparatuses to do this. And interestingly, the first to do this are actually the Soviets. The Soviet Union establishes what we call the Soviet Extraordinary State Commission. It's actually got a much longer name in Russian. It's like the Soviet Extraordinary State Commission and it goes on and on about, you know, the documentation of Nazi violent crime against blah, 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 blah. But we call it the Soviet Extraordinary State Commission. And this was founded in November of 1942. And it begins operating as territory that had previously been controlled by the Nazis is reconquered by the Red Army. Investigators from the Extraordinary State Commission follow. And, you know, they're doing a bunch of different things. You know, they are documenting the sort of cash value of destruction by the Nazis, but they're also documenting the killing and everything else. And as these reports, I always say, as these reports go up higher in the Soviet apparatus, they sort of become less and less useful because they become more and more vague. But the initial reports, the oral testimonies, are actually quite good, and they do delineate Jewish suffering and Holocaust suffering as well. Again, that's the sort of thing that kind of gets rubbed out the higher up you go. Anyway, point being that the Soviets are doing this already, right?
And then we get in 1943, don't we? We get the Moscow declarations, which is
right.
when the Allied leaders come together. And one of those is a statement on atrocities. And it takes this principle and really at that point hammers at home that it's not just going to be the Soviets who are doing this. This is going to be a full Allied approach that, you know, and they're openly doing it. They're declaring almost to the Germans to say, look, after when this war is over and we are going to win it, those suspected of wartime atrocities are going to be put on trial. And more importantly, what they actually say they're going to do is they're going to send them initially, at least, to the country in which they committed the crimes for trial. And I think that sometimes gets forgotten when most people might be aware of the Nuremberg trials, the sort of the high profile stuff that begins in October 1945. But there is a commitment by the Allies that actually, no, if you did your crime in Poland, then we will send you to the Polish to have to be tried. And that's as you say, these people know that whether they agree with them or whether they agree with them or not, they know the crimes they're committing and they now know the consequences. And so it's sort of from that point on that, informally at least, figures are already now thinking, what are they going to do after the war?
Well, and even you know, before the end of the war as well. I mean, that's sort of one step. But then you have later declarations as well. So like Franklin Roosevelt, the United States president, issues a statement in March 1944, again, reiterating this, where he's saying that anyone who's taken part in the Holocaust is going to be equally guilty and be prosecuted. And then in the context of Hungary, in June 1944, you know, the Allies literally are dropping leaflets saying, we know what you're doing, in terms of the reference, the deportation of Hungarian Jews to Auschwitz, and you're on notice. And even to the extent of, at certain points in the war at that period, the Allies are broadcasting names of Nazis that are doing things, right? So there's very much the understanding that there's going to be, unlike in the First World War, which again didn't see the same level of crimes against humanity, but there was an idea after the First World War that there would be this kind of war crimes commission that would have tried people, but really that doesn't get off the ground, the sort of Leipzig trials, et cetera. And so the message is very clear to the Nazis at the end of the Second World War that, no, this is going to be a fundamental part of Allied administration of Europe, is we are going to hunt these people down. In some ways, and well, certainly at the end of the war, Nazi war criminals are far more afraid of being sent back to Poland or the Soviet Union or some other place in the East, because they know what's going to happen to them. And they'll see what happens to Rudolf Hess, for example, at Auschwitz. I mean, they take him back and they hang him right at Auschwitz. So the chances of getting away with it, as it were, become even less, especially as the Allies are threatening to send people back, which, as you sort of noted in the introduction, they don't really follow through on that exactly, particularly as time goes on. But one of the things we'll talk about, I think, is that the chronology of this is that a lot of the sort of escaping behavior that we're talking about takes place in the first 5, 6, 7 years after the end of the war. And then the calculus can change as people sort of realize what the actual reality on the ground is.
I think that's it. And you mentioned Hess there and Rudolf Hess, and I think that's a really good example of this. Is you get, there are certain key figures who know they're going to be high profile targets, and therefore they're always got the urge to flee, but they're not necessarily the thousands of people on the ground doing the work. And as you say, there's almost a sort of series of waves of movements of people around this. You get that initial one that happens immediately as war's ending. And it's worth thinking about the sort of the chaotic situation that exists at the end of this. And this will play slightly into the routes that people take when they get away to other countries, which we'll talk about in a bit. But remember, we're pre-computers here. We're pre-easy ability to do photos and visual IDs on things. Even your average ID card for an individual might not have a photo on it. It might just have a description of an individual. So it's far easier in this kind of background noise with state logistics and military logistics sort of starting to collapse, that if, say, you're a German army officer who was serving in Italy and you were involved in some shootings of civilians or similar, you are going to probably be afraid initially, at least, that you may be subject to these trials, to being tried for what you did. And you may decide that on your official way back to Germany, if you're moving with your German army unit, that you might disappear. Or after the war, you might still be in Italy when the war ends, in which case you do the same thing. You go, well, actually, I'm just going to disappear into the background noise of a chaotic society and see what happens. So you get, do remember when we're talking about this, that certainly at the beginning of this, it's relatively easy for people to fade into the background and disappear. And a lot of that goes on, and there's waves of movement and everything else.
Well, it's important. I think it's also important to point out, as you're doing, that we have a moment at the end of the Second World War, which is like the largest population disruption in European history, right? You have millions of prisoners from all parts of Europe that have been moved around, Jews and non-Jews. You have prisoners of war of various stripes who've been moved around. You have German people of German ethnicity that are fleeing Eastern Europe, not for any particularly nefarious reason, but because they know they're going to be victimized by the Soviets. The Czechoslovakian government, you know, is expelling large numbers of ethnic Germans as well. So what you have, as you rightly point out, is just this massive sort of swirling cauldron of people all over the place, many of whom have completely legitimate reasons to have not have any ID available or whatever, right? People who are fleeing all kinds of oppression or just the general flotsam and jetsam of war itself. So as you point out, you know, this creates a very sort of chaotic environment for trying to identify who someone is. And again, we are in an area where it's already, you know, identification is a both easily faked and hard to sort of standardize across an entire continent. And one of the things that is also important to sort of highlight here is that we don't know as much about the Holocaust as we do now. You know, your average listener, even if they are not sort of an expert or even an aficionado of reading about the Holocaust, probably knows a lot more in some ways now than people did in 1945 or 46. So it's not the case necessarily. I mean, there are lists that are developed by the Allies saying, like, these are the people that we are trying to catch. Those lists are updated as they talk to survivors, as they talk to people. But that's how they're created. They haven't had time to sort of root through all the millions of pages of Nazi documents to sort of figure out for themselves who the bad people are, right? So they know from sort of the high-ranking Nazis, they know if they have survivors who sort of say, this is a guy that was the commandant of the camp or whatever. But a lot of the lower-ranking people are not yet showing up as war criminals. So they have a basically the war criminals kind of have a head start here, because most of them, unless you're one of the sort of all-stars, no one's looking for you in the first place. You know, and there's some great examples even from the book that I just wrote of the SS men, you know, and what they tried to do after the war. And one of them, for example, is Peter Blum, a horrible SS man at Janowska camp. And I actually have his International Refugee Organization documents that I found in the Bad Aulsen archive. And he, it's really interesting because he was an ethnic German, meaning he was of German ethnicity, but he lived outside of Germany. He was from the Banat region, which is sort of Yugoslavia, Hungary area. And so in his documents, he states that he was in the Hungarian military, that he is fleeing Soviet oppression, and he would like to go to the United States. And what's really interesting is that we have in that document, we have the notes from the counterintelligence corps guy who reviewed it. And essentially he says, guy has an interesting scar under his arm, i.e. where the SS tattoo would have been. I don't believe him, denied. Right. And so this guy ends up in Germany. And that's great. I mean, that's like a success story, but as we'll talk about, you know, they're not always sort of as successful. It's kind of a hit or miss.
Yeah.
Hit or miss thing.
And I think that's something, again, people really need to bear in mind when we talk about this. And this is one of those things that often we tend to, as humans, we tend to try and project a level of order onto things that sometimes don't exist because we like structures. Structures give us something to, if it's a big shadowy organization that's helping lots of Nazis escape, you can be angry at the big shadowy organization. We don't have to confront the fact that normal people can do nasty things and normal people can help people who did nasty things. And one thing, and this is a good opportunity to talk about, is this is one of the ways that actually a lot of these people are able to move and to end up, and we'll talk about Rome and why Rome's important and Genoa are important in a moment, but people will end up in these Italian cities And they can be there and they can say, well, yeah, I was a soldier. I was a German soldier. I was in the army. Obviously, the Allies have won. They're going to come after everyone because, you know, victor's peace, all of this. Oh, I know some of my colleagues did some bad things. I didn't. And there's the standard almost thing that you see. You know, it's very common. We talk about it in the context of abusers, which is you get that concept of where people go, well, he was always nice to me. He was always nice to me. And so he's a nice guy. And people can be very good at being nice to one set of people and awful to other groups of people. And so sometimes there's an amount of benefit of doubt given. And I've seen this in accounts, when you look at accounts, particularly from people who help later on, people like Mengele escape and stuff like that, where they say, well, yeah, I didn't realize how bad he was. And by the time I knew how bad he was, I'm too roped into it. And there's a bit of self-justification there in hindsight. But there's also an element of, yeah, you know, there's this idea of a sort of alter kameraden, that if you were a soldier and you fought alongside someone and your old army buddy turns up and says, I need a bit of a hand. Can I stay at your house for a while? Do you know somebody who can get me some papers? You're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Or if they turn up and they say, you don't know me, but I served alongside this other guy who served alongside you. And these are the kind of networks that people are moving through as they're starting to shift and leave Europe, isn't it?
Well, and some of them are actually even more explicit than that. I mean, you have the organization of former Waffen-SS veterans. It's basically a self-help organization and a lobbying organization for the Waffen-SS after the war. And they have a not altogether happy relationship with the Allgemeine SS, which is the camp SS, you know, not to excuse the Waffen-SS guys, because, you know, my most recent work, the Commandant of Unoska was a Waffen-SS guy, and most of the guards were Waffen-SS guys. So you didn't have to be an Allgemeine SS, a General SS, to sort of be one of the bad guys. But you have this organization. And there's also evidence that, and we see this later on, much later on in the 60s in Germany, that there is this informal network. And again, as you rightly point out, you know, that there, it isn't sort of the sort of secret underground, well-organized machine, but it's word of mouth. It's essentially the equivalent of like a fridge magnet that says, if you're questioned by the police about war crimes, call this attorney. And he specializes in defending you. That's the sort of later iteration of this, right? And so you will have the same guy defending over time multiple bad Nazis. In the earlier period that we're talking about, the Ratline periods, you know, it's something similar. It's this word of mouth, which is what makes it sort of hard for historians to really sort of track it down in extreme detail. I mean, people like Richard Breitman and Gerald Steinecker and others have done this to the extent that it's possible, but because there's not sort of this secret organization you can find the documents from, it is very much a go to this inn in South Tyrol and ask for so-and-so and tell him that you need a path to Italy or whatever. But it's well known enough. And of course, these guys will talk about, you know, a lot of the people know exactly who everybody is and exactly how bad they are. And, you know, again, I'll bring another piece of context going back to sort of the situation in Europe. That's worth pointing out, is that there's money to be made in smuggling people, full stop, regardless of who they are. And so you do have these very, very strange moments where you have Jews, Holocaust survivors, attempting to get to Palestine, which at that point is illegal, right? And so they are in some ways and oftentimes using the same underground people smuggling routes that the Nazis are using. And are being shepherded through by people smugglers who don't really care who they're smuggling as long as the money spends. And so this is another thing that's taking place as well. You have lots of people that are moving. One thing you brought up earlier, I think, is worth pointing out. There are people who are fleeing the Soviet bloc because they don't want to be in the Soviet Union, who haven't done anything wrong either. And based on everything that people knew at the time about the Soviets, that's a very compelling and logical explanation for why you might be on the run.
And this is actually the origin of the word, the phrase, the ratlines. The ratlines as an idea. I mean, it's a wonderfully evocative word, and particularly in English, because we think of rats and we think, oh, well, they're helping rats escape. It's almost got that kind of built-in horror into it. But actually, it's a naval reference. It's a reference to the fact that the ratlines on a ship's mast are the sort of the small ropes that almost form a ladder so that you can climb the mast if you need to get up the last. So, and it's actually, it's first used in American documents. It's in reference in American efforts to do exactly what you were talking about there, which is to move people out of former Soviet state or lands that are now Soviet controlled, and also out of what we now know, or what we now know as the Balkans, what was Yugoslavia and areas like that. So the phrase itself only gains currency actually in I think it's in the 50s when Klaus Barbie is brought back to France and tried, and that's when it gains currency. But yeah, it's an enormous movement of people. And for readers, for context, there are many, many ways that people move through this informal network and get to places. There's really two key areas we will focus on and maybe talk about a bit more in detail, one more so than other. The two primary routes out really are Spain and Italy, for various reasons in terms of how they link up and connect, particularly with South America, because a lot of the South American countries at this time, they're friendly territory for people to move to. They have, in many places, existing German communities. They are vast countries where actually it's very easy to fade into the background. And in various of those countries, they have right-wing or right-wing adjacent leaderships that are quite happy to take on board these people. Not least because a lot of these guys are, in inverted commas, experts at things.
Yeah, I mean, and before we get to those two, I want to point out a couple other ones, right? Because I like the idea of talking about rat lines with an S, plural, right? Because as we've suggested, and we'll talk about Odessa probably a little bit later, but there is no sort of single one where you sort of show up and you're on an escalator that takes you out, right? There are multiple different routes. They do arrive at sort of choke points where organizations are important. But there's also a couple that we're not really focused on for the purposes of this that I think we should be mentioned. And one of them is Operation Paperclip / Overcast, right? Which is the American operation to literally pluck Nazis out of Europe and bring them to the United States if they are likely to be scientists that have some kind of expertise, either military or civilian scientific. The famous is Wernher von Braun, you know, who's guilty of war crimes in the sense that he created the V2 rockets that were launched against civilians, but also that he knowingly used slave labor to build these things, etc. But also people like Walter Schreiber, who was a doctor at the Ravensbrück concentration camp, who, after this comes to light, the Americans then funnel to South America along with everybody else. And the Soviets do something similar, though it's much less voluntary. It's more of a sort of abducting German scientists, engineers, et cetera, to go work in Soviet Union. But actually, in some ways, that allows them to then, when they're repatriated, to launder their background as well. And then they just become POWs, right? And that is one of the routes.
And on top of that, I mean, I'll add before anyone British starts trying to feel smug about this, I challenge you to go look up Operation Backfire, which is effectively the British operation in a very similar, more low key version of Paperclip, but is primarily focused on getting rocket engineers out, because it's how we end up with a space program in the '70s. There is a point where there is an entire unit in the British Army that is composed of ex-German rocketry people lobbing V2 rockets out over the Baltic alongside British officers.
And this is important in the context of what we're talking about for this episode, because these guys are looking for safe ways out of prosecution. And again, that's what makes these two, not so much the Soviet, but the Allied searches for scientists important, because they're saying, look, here's a great way for me to avoid prosecution. They're going to take me and my family to California or whatever, and that's great. And that's a way for them to avoid, because a lot of these guys are guilty of something, because it's very hard to be a Nazi of any importance and not be guilty of something. So that there's that sort of government one. And again, we can also talk maybe a little bit about the they're not so much rat lines, but as the Allies start to use particular Nazis for other things like counterintelligence and then that gets found out. That's how Barbie stays free for so many years, right? Is that the Allies are using, there's this organization, Gala, and this sort of shadowy organization from a former German military intelligence guy, who also then is able to kind of get his buddies into this thing. And this gets back, we'll talk more about this, I'm sure, but there's the whole anti-communist after World War II.
There's one other route I want to give a shout out to, as you say, that this is rat lines, plural, which is the movement of German officers and others through Finland into Sweden. So actually there's a laundering process that is, if you can get to Finland, you can get through to Sweden. And so, like you say, these things are happening all over the place. What maybe we'll do is we'll, because I think you're right, and particularly because it ties into the anti-communist thing and how that evolves, Italy becomes a key thing to, I think, talk about in the complexity of this. So let's maybe get Spain out of the way quickly, because Spain, I think, is a good way of just giving a sense some of the mechanics of how this might work. If you imagine maybe you were in occupied France, you were in Vichy when you were in service, or you can get to those places. Then obviously, if you can get over the Alps, you're into Spain. Spain is ostensibly a friendly territory to be in. It's run by Franco. And there's always been a strong fascist element of hub of those German citizens and other Nazis from occupied territories in France and Belgium that have started to accrue in, particularly in Madrid and then out towards the coast. So if you think of everything we've talked about already, listeners, you're into this, you can imagine how this all comes together. You know, there are old comrades you can hook up with, or comrades of comrades. There are loose organizations of, in inverted commas, veterans that you can interact with. You're in a relatively friendly country and region. And from there, you can get good links out to Africa or to overseas, particularly to Argentina, where you can move on. And that does become a route that various people take over a period. So let's say that 5 years or so, isn't it, beyond after the war?
Yeah, I mean, and Spain, of course, has this weird sort of status during the war as this neutral state. And so there is this kind of weird allied agents and Nazi agents like in Spain during the war doing things in this neutral power. And that remains right after the war. So if you get to Spain, you have someone that is at least sympathetic, right? You know, Franco, we wouldn't say is necessarily a Nazi, and in many ways had some disagreements, particularly after the war, with the Nazis, but he's sympathetic to it. And even then, you know, ultimately what you have, yes, you have a welcoming environment in Spain, but ultimately, again, it's the Vatican and the Red Cross that are, even in Spain, are the ones that are providing the actual documents to make it possible. But Spain offers, for a lot of these guys, I think, a moment of like a breather, like some space, right? Because they don't have to be sort of looking over their shoulders. But it's also important to point out that, as we'll talk about, you know, the vast majority of these people that are fleeing go through Italy. And also important to point out, particularly in the context of Spain as well, that we're not just talking about sort of German Nazis. We're also talking about the Ustasha, which was the Croatian collaborator organization, people like Ante Pavelic, and those perpetrators who were just, in many ways, just as bad and killed lots of people as well. Hungarian Nazis, even Belgian, Landegrelle ends up in Spain, Hungarians, Ukrainian guards. So you have a large number of people who, particularly at the higher-ups, but they're there as well, beyond just Nazis. And again, this goes back to our conversation earlier about the sort of difficult, swirling cauldron of people. Because alongside those people who are war criminals, you have an actual Czech nationalist who wants to flee from the Soviets, right? So it makes it difficult.
And Red Cross documentation is critical to this, and the Red Cross is doing its best to make sure that people in these vast movements of people being moved around have some kind of identification papers that they can use. And actually, one of the reasons that Argentina is such a popular destination is, of course, because, like a number of countries, Argentina says, look, we know you're not going to have a passport. If you've got your Red Cross papers, we will, for the purposes of immigration, treat that as if it was a passport. That is a big factor in allowing them to do this. And as with any situation where you've got lots of people issuing lots of documents, that creates opportunities for abuse within it for the bad actors. And just to pick up on what you were saying about like the figures, the non-German figures in this. Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the key players in setting up that initial route through Spain is Pierre Daye, who's Belgian fascist journalist. He served in World War I in the Belgian army. He has close links to Argentina, and that's why he becomes a vector for this. Or Charles Lescat, who's a French Argentine citizen and is a French journalist, and eventually, I think, does get tried in France for his activities. But again, as you were saying earlier, it's these people can operate with freedom because it's still emerging what we might call, in inverted commas, minor characters, these facilitators, these people who did the acts were involved in.
I mean, and you know, we can talk about, as we sort of moved to Italy, we can talk about the role of the Red Cross, because, you know, like anything else, it's a combination of incompetence. And I say that not so much in a negative way, but just as you're pointing out, like it's very difficult for people to handle all these people and know who they're looking for. Just for listeners to remember, I mean, this is not an era of computers. So it's not like where, you know, if you land at Heathrow, someone can put your name into a computer and run it against all the other files in Europe or Interpol or whatever to find out. I mean, it's literally, if you're going to catch one of these guys, you have to hope that the person going over your documents, even if using your real name, which sometimes happened, you know, is able to sort of somehow have a piece of paper that references, look for these people. That person's name has to be on it. He has to look at that document and somehow make the connection, right? So all of this is actually, it's not the easiest thing to do, which is why that SS tattoo is super useful, because you can make the guy take his shirt off and raise his arms. And if he has a tattoo on him, then at least you know he's in the SS, which is a pretty easy disqualification, you know, which is why people like Peter Blume, I talked about earlier, but also Mengele, who didn't have an SS tattoo, is able to kind of, in some ways, slip through the nets, because you're missing that sort of big net of like, okay, well, you're in the SS, you go into a different pot.
Yeah, and let's talk about Italy then, because I think, as you say, Italy is the primary path for so many of these people. And geographically, like, listeners it doesn't take a lot of work to guess why you might have a shift of people down towards Italy. Geographically, you're moving through Austria. There are many Austrian Nazis who are involved in this movement. There's good, strong rail links between Germany and Italy and Austria. So there's a drift downwards. Once you get there, though, there's sort of, you'll move into places like Bolzano in the South Tyrol. You'll find those informal networks there. As you were saying, it's the go speak to this guy at this pub and he'll push you in the right direction. He'll punt you on. He'll move all of that. But why politically is Italy very susceptible and very, very open to this kind of thing at the time?
Well, I mean, I think, again, just to highlight one more thing before I get to that. I mean, like, the role of the South Tyrol and the Tyrol in general, so like the southern part of the southwestern part of Austria and the northern part of northeastern part of Italy, are really important, again, because somebody walking around with a German accent is not going to be weird. It's, you know, it's not like if you were an American, you know, trying to get out of China or something, right, where it's very obvious that you're out of place. So that's helpful. Italy in general, you know, it's not so much because, of course, Italy, though it was fascist, it does sort of eject out of the war in 1943. So it's not exactly that Italy as a country was particularly hospitable to fascists, particularly Nazis, if you think about, you know, because the Nazis certainly weren't the best of allies, even to the Italians. It's much more that the Vatican is there. And this raises a really important and very complex, you know, historical question, which is the Vatican's role or reaction to, I suppose, the Holocaust and the Nazi state, which is a, you know, a very important conversation. And I would argue, in fact, their actions in the post-war regarding fleeing war criminals is part of the best explanation for that, because during the war, there are, if you're an apologist for the Vatican, you know, you say, look, what's the Vatican going to do? The Nazis control Europe. They control, for all intents and purposes, Italy. They could, if they wanted, bomb the Vatican, destroy the Vatican, occupy the Vatican, et cetera, et cetera. You're just trying, again, in the most charitable light, the Catholic Church is just trying to survive the war. And again, as I say, I think that's the most charitable explanation. But say we go with that, then all of that goes away at the end of the war. So then why are they helping Nazi war criminals or war criminals in general escape? And so here you have, and again, there's still work to be done on this because a lot of the files have only become recently available or are still not available about this. So again, a shout out to Gerald Steinecker's work on this because he's done a lot of the really archival deep digs into the Vatican and the Red Cross and their connections and what they're doing with war criminals. But taking a step back to Pius XII, who is the Pope at the time, during the war and after, you know, and he is a Germanophile. Like he likes Germany. He was originally essentially the papal ambassador to Germany. He spent lots of time there. He's a diplomatic guy. He's an institution guy, unlike his predecessor, who was very much a pastoralist. Pius the 11th he's a people person, cares about people. That's how he came up ministering to people, which explains a lot about his attitudes towards the Holocaust and to Jews. Had he been alive, he already was in the process of trying to revise the Catholic Church's relationship with Jews and address things like anti-Semitism. But he dies, of course, before the war. But Pius XII is an organization guy. He's not really a touchy-feely pastoralist. He's concerned about politics, you know, geopolitical standing of the church, et cetera, et cetera. And so he's very much focused on the communist threat to religion in general and the Catholic Church in particular. You know, he sees that as the existential threat. And so that anybody who fights communism in his book is good. And this, of course, filters down into the lower ranks of the Catholic Church where necessary. I'm not suggesting that every priest or every Vatican official, you know, holds that view, but leaders create climates. And that's the climate that creates.
And they create climates and they create opportunities.
Yeah.
And in this case, those opportunities can be that if you might have someone, and we'll know, good example we'll bring up now is Bishop Alois Soudal, who becomes critical to so much of this, of these movements of these people. He's an Austrian German. I think he's an Austrian, actually. But he's the head of the Austrian German congregation of Santa Maria dell'Anima in Rome. He's a very powerful man. And as you say, the leadership creates environments, and it creates an environment in which he is empowered to effectively act as a vector for so many of particularly high profile people who pass through Rome and get those passports, get those Red Cross documents. I've seen recently there's more evidence now as well that not only was he getting genuine Red Cross documents, but actually there were times when he was signing them himself and issuing these as effectively as false papers. So there can be zero doubt, listener, in the idea that elements of the church are absolutely complicit in moving these people out of Europe.
He wasn't even hiding it. In 1937, he wrote a book basically saying, here's why Nazism is great. And then he sent it to Hitler personally. So he is an out and out open supporter of Nazism. And again, the institution that he's a part of provides cover for these Nazis, because again, it would not be weird to have someone with a German accent going to the Santa Maria dell'Anima church, which is the church for German speakers in Rome. And so Hudal and other folks are not only sort of doing the documentation piece, they're also physically harboring these people at times.
A good example of that is Baron Otto Vector, who is governor Krakow, then Galicia, and is absolutely complicit in everything that goes on in these places. He makes his way eventually. He's a good example of someone who doesn't really move far first. He takes that initial move and goes, I'm just going to be in the mountains near my house. Let's see how this shakes out. And then it's really after Hess is sieved, after that he, with help from his wife, with help from others, drifts gradually down towards Rome and starts to think about trying to make those connections and get out. And yeah, the Bishop Hudal arranges for him to stay in a nice discreet cell in the monastery. And he's not the only person he does that for. There's a full hotel system running within Catholic properties here for fleeing Nazis.
So Franz Stangl was the commandant of the Sobibor and Treblinka extermination centers. Here's a guy with millions of deaths on his directly on his hands. And he flees, and another, this speaks to another of the points you brought up earlier, with a guy named Gustav Wagner. Wagner was one of his guards, a notorious, you know, SS officer at Treblinka. Together, so they go together, right, to Italy to get their Red Cross passports and then to flee. And, you know, interestingly, Stangl, again, shout out to Gita Sereni and her book, Into That Darkness, which I recommend everybody read because it's a phenomenal,
incredible read.
Just a phenomenal book about the Holocaust. But she interviews Stangl, and he says that when he showed up, Hudal didn't greet him by his pseudonym or anything. He said, "Oh, Franz Stangl, I've been expecting you." And so, like, the argument that these people were hiding their identities from the people that were helping them, I always find to be a little bit tendentious, because they knew who these people were for the most part. And there were lots and lots of Germans who, even Germans who were in the Wehrmacht or whatever else, who had great credentials of fighting the communists, who didn't need to flee Europe. Right? I mean, because they had just fought them to German, they just fought the Soviets. They weren't sort of deeply complicit in the camp system or in the Holocaust per se. So you have to know at this point, if you're dealing with Antti Pavelich or Franz Stangl or, you know, Josef Mengele, these are people that have done something particular, because it's only the people that have really done something awful for the most part that are going through this. Because as we pointed out, you know, everybody else is kind of thinking, ah, well, you know, let me see if they're going to look out for me.
And I think the anti-communism thing is big here, because this is why we start to see, jumping ahead slightly, this is why we start to see a tailing off of people making an escape towards as time goes on. Because as the West, as Britain, as the Cold War kicks in, as the US refocus around the Soviet threat, suddenly those people become far more useful to retain, or at least to try and retain their networks, their connection networks. Because it's worth remembering that so many Western agencies had no networks within the Soviet Union or those Soviet, now occupied Soviet states, whereas there was a reasonable chance that some of these people fleeing would have information that would help them set up. I mean, there's documentation that shows that, for example, that Hudel was at various points in the pay of the US. You know, so whilst he's moving these key figures out, and while the US and the British are ostensibly hunting them, at the same time, at various points, the US are effectively going, look, if you get anyone that might be of interest to us, do push them in our direction. And I think that shows that this is a really murky situation all round.
Well, I mean, and that's a great point. I mean, and the Galen organization is interesting in that regard, because at some levels, you know, there's a specific knowledge that's being sought and a generic knowledge that's being sought. And the specific knowledge is sort of like, how did you fight communists? How did you fight the Soviets? And so Galen gets this sort of, I mean, he's all right, but he's, you know, he's not some sort of four-dimensional chess genius. But there's an idea on the Allies that, well, these people have this really good experience and, you know, understanding of how to investigate or how the Soviets work, which I always think is quite ironic, considering that the Soviets destroyed the German military. So clearly it's not working that well. But then there's this generic knowledge. And I think this is where things get even more morally problematic. Because the generic knowledge is just, you know how to torture people and you know how to create an oppressive police state, you know, and we see this played out in the most part in some of these foreign countries. There are a number of people who flee to Middle Eastern countries, Egypt and Syria, but also South America, who really are kind of doing their old job in these new countries, and their old job being repression, interrogation, torture, these kinds of things. These are what people are interested in, and they just change the target essentially to communism in these places. Barbie is another example. Klaus Barbie, you know, an SS officer in Lyon in France. He's responsible for all kinds of atrocities, the deportation of the Jews of Lyon, but also the murder of Jean Moulin, who was a high-profile French resistor, and so that sort of boosted him up onto the national stage, as it were. But the Americans are interested in him as a guy who knows how to, you know, run a counterintelligence organization, which is not really what he was super competent at. But there's this, after the war, there is this knee-jerk kind of, oh my gosh, now we're facing the Soviets. and we need to sort of figure out everything that we want to know. I mean, a different episode to do, but the American military does this as well by grabbing all the German generals and saying, come over to the United States and write your memoirs, which is absurd. Because, like, what are we learning from a self-serving memoir by the guys who lost the Soviets? But it's a symptom of a larger problem, which is this desire to sort of capture expertise.
As you say, that's, and I do think it's important that we stress that it's not just that the expertise is wanted to be captured by people like Perón as he comes to power in Argentina or areas like that. This is useful knowledge to the Allies, and where it is possible for the British or for the Americans, they'll often do an exercise. How bad are your crimes? Can we just, you know, whitewash that bit out? We'll take that bit out of your record. We'll give you some papers. You then move on. Congrats. You're now cleaned. And I think what we do need to talk about here is that we've talked about people escaping, about people moving to these states. And, you know, that is you're into the five figures. You're into the tens of thousands of people who did this. There are far more people who don't move at all, aren't there?
And that in some ways is kind of the real takeaway from this. The vast majority of Nazi war criminals, and particularly the ones with the dirtiest hands, the ones that had physically done this, as well as the ones with other kinds of dirty hands, they never flee. They go home and live a normal life for all intents and purposes for most of these guys. You have a Nazi pediatrician who was murdering children as part of the euthanasia program, goes home and becomes a pediatrician again. Other Nazi doctors going back to private practice until they're outed or they're not outed at all. And that's the larger sort of takeaway from this, is that while the myth of the Odessa, you know, secretive Nazi organization that wants to establish a Fourth Reich is very seductive and it makes for great movies and TV, and that, yes, absolutely lots and lots of people escape justice with the complicity of the Red Cross, whose leader was also in many ways a Nazi sympathizer. But really, the biggest miscarriage of justice in some ways is not people fleeing. It's the people that were there to be caught and nobody was looking for them, which is lots and lots and lots of people who end up not being the focus for a long time of investigation because for a variety of reasons. You know, one is the post-war Cold War context, you know, which is we had Nuremberg, we got those guys, let's draw a line under it and sort of move on. We don't want to continue to sort of antagonize our German allies now by continuing to poke them in the eye about all these Nazis that were there. And then, of course, in 1949, Germany regains control of prosecuting Nazi war criminals. It chooses, first and foremost, to use a legal regimen that was in place before the war, which makes it difficult to prosecute many war criminals. And it's not super interested in going after these guys. And so, again, the biggest miscarriage of justice is that most of these people live normal lives in their villages and towns in Germany.
I know on your podcast, and we'll link to episode in the show notes. You did a great episode with Bettina Anton, I think it is, on her work. So, listeners, she's done a lot of work into looking at Josef Mengele while he was in Argentina and what he was this situation there and anything else. And I remember listening to that when I first listened to that episode. Something that stuck with me from something she said in there was that one of the reasons that his family were able to help him relatively easily from abroad was because, or people locally in that were able to help him as much as because it was a crime in Argentina to help. On paper, it was a crime in Argentina to help a known escape or suspected escaped war criminal. It was not a crime in Germany if they were a member of your family. And I remember growing up, I'm in the sort of early 90s, my family would take in exchange, you know, foreign students as a way of earning a bit of extra money. And a lot of those came from Germany because my dad did the whole Auf Wiedersehen Pet thing back in the day. He went and worked in Dortmund as a builder for years. So he had close local connections there and spoke a bit of German. And something that I remember is I must have been about 12, 13. So this is about 93, 94. And we had a university student. And he was a German history student. And he said something that has stuck with me to this day, which is when we were talking about the war and everything else, he said, the thing you have to remember with us, and he meant Germans and his generation of Germans in particular, I think, and how he was being brought up, was that we are brought up to know that my granddad is never a Nazi. Everyone else's granddads were. And that stuck with me ever since then as such a a really succinct way of how we as humans rationalize things, deal with things and all of that. And that, like you say, most of these people don't need to leave. They don't need to move. It's that banality of evil that just stays.
Well, it's a societal thing too. You know, for example, Peter Blum that I mentioned multiple times before, he actually ends up ultimately being tried for his crimes in the Nazi camp and convicted. He serves 7 years in prison. And then he goes home and he runs the village band. You know, he's in the village newsletters and stuff. And again, it's not a secret that this guy went to prison for 7 years after being convicted. Because of course the trial for the Inoske is in all the papers, right? So it's families, but it's also a society that is not ostracizing this guy and these other ones. Many of them, you know, may not be trumpeting their sort of Nazi past, but I feel like, you know, people know, some people know, and it's not a huge secret. And, you know, for a lot of post-war German society, particularly of the wartime generation, now we see different things with the kids, but, you know, we have a society that is generally accepting or at a minimum doesn't want to ask the questions for afraid of getting the answers and having to deal with the answers.
I lived in New York for a few years, and I vividly remember flying over there and completing my immigration visas and all of that kind of thing. And there was a box that I literally had to tick on the visas that said, "Have you ever committed war crimes?" And I could tick the no box. And I remember as I was doing it thinking, just imagining Wernher von Braun sat there looking at that form and going, done them.
Yeah.
Have you ever committed war crimes? Have you ever been involved in a military operation against the United States? And you can just almost imagine him going, yeah.
And for a certain period of time, it literally said, have you been a member of the Nazi party and stuff like that? And I don't know if it still does. And of course, you know, the United States is also flooded ultimately with a lot of these folks, in Canada as well, particularly with the sort of Ukrainian perpetrators, right? Just a connection, you know, one of the Ukrainian policemen in Lviv who had killed Jews as a part of Roundup ends up in like Michigan, and he's drawn there by a Ukrainian American sort of refugee organization that's supporting him, right? So again, we talk about rat lines, and there are these other ones as well, these sort of anchor communities drawing people from their ethnicity or their national origin into their town. And people for whom, you know, again, the anti-communist thing is, that's the credential, and everything else is immaterial.
So we'll carry on talking a bit more in a second. So if you're a listener to, or if you're a subscriber to via untitled-history.com, do hang around because we'll be talking a bit more, because I find this whole thing fascinating. I want to talk to you in particular about Julius Dortmüller. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but we'll talk about that in a bit. But before we do that, I do absolutely want to give a shout out to several of your books, quite frankly. So obviously your most recent book is Between the Wires. I've not read this one yet. I've got it pre-ordered, but I haven't read it yet. I've got the paperback pre-ordered via bookshop.org. But my first became familiar with your work with Marching Into Darkness. And it would be okay if you maybe just for a minute describe what Marching Into Darkness is, and because it's absolutely a subject as well I'm going to get you back on for in future.
Sure, yeah. I mean, what I wanted to do was look at this clean Wehrmacht myth, the idea that the Wehrmacht, the German army, was sort of fighting this war against Soviets, it was not involved in the Holocaust. And so Marching Into Darkness is essentially, it follows a series of units in the same place, in the same time in Belarus, looking at the small unit level, individual soldiers level, what are these units of Wehrmacht, German army units, doing in the context of the Holocaust? And how does their behavior sort of escalate over time? And so I look at documentation, because there are several court cases that sort of form the kernel of each one of these episodes, but they generate a lot of testimony, a lot of interrogation documents. And so looking at sort of what are these guys actually doing? You know, when we say the Wehrmacht was complicit in the Holocaust, what I'm trying to answer in Marching Into Darkness is, what does that actually look like? What does complicity specifically look like? What are people doing? And I think I show that, you know, that there are lots and lots of ways, but they are very, very complicit, and that ultimately it's a question of opportunity and not motive. meaning that the Wehrmacht as an organization is more or less willing to participate. It's only a question of, you know, are they being asked to, or are they in a situation where that's something that they do? And again, one of the things that I also show in that book, you know, is that there were people who didn't. I mean, I think that those people are important as well, even though they're the minority, but the minority proves the rule, right? Which is some people clearly knew that this was wrong and decided not to do it, right? So that's kind of what a general synopsis of the book.
And also want to flag, obviously, you've got the Holocaust History Podcast, which is one of my favorite podcasts. It's very, very good. If I can just flag up two specific episodes, again, listeners, sort of around this that are well worth digging into. We mentioned her already. The episode with Bettina Anton on Mengele in South America, I think, is a fantastic episode. But also you did a Nuremberg Trials episode as well, which I think is really, really good. I really enjoyed that one. And in terms of slightly out there topics that absolutely are turning up on this podcast again, because I'm going to steal your guest for it, is the role of the Wehrmacht chaplaincy in World War II is out there.
Yeah, and also I'll really point out, there are a couple others that are relevant for this topic. So I had David Marwell on.
He's
an historian who actually hunted Eichmann for the State Department, or not Eichmann, Mengele for the State Department. And his recollections are really fascinating. And also, if you're interested in this topic, Jane Pershing's episode about Nazi and collaborator and fascist war criminals coming to Australia also touches very much on this, about immigration policy and how Australia kind of looked the other way because it wanted to get people in. So there are some other things that might be, particularly if you're interested in this topic, you might want to check out.
But it's a fantastic podcast. I should also flag up, listeners, if you like your YouTubes, obviously we've got the channel for this podcast, but our sister Battle Guide podcast, I think, has got a two-part series on Eichmann currently going on. Really, really good. I think part one will have dropped by the time this podcast is released. Part two might be imminent. But generally, if you've enjoyed listening, then please don't forget to review us on whatever your podcast app of choice is. Putting those stars in, putting a comment, those are the things that mean this will bump up into other people's feeds who may learn some stuff, hopefully, as well, and maybe stop spreading rumors about weird shadowy organizations called Odessa. But don't forget to review us. It's always appreciated. Again, if you want the extra bit that we're about to talk to, join us on theuntitledhistory.com. You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
I mean, we didn't actually talk about the Odessa myth, which is kind of interesting. It's a great example of a really good story getting away in the way of the history. It's this idea that there is this, again, the kind of what we've been mentioning the entire podcast, right? This shadowy organization, but it's an organization of high-ranking, well-placed, well-funded former Nazis who have this very efficient way to let Nazis escape Europe. Also adding on to this for the purposes of establishing essentially later on a Fourth Reich or a second go at Nazism.
The thing I love about all of that as well is, like, you know, Mengele is alive when some of this stuff is being released. He's living in Argentina, not living in luxury. And he's watching this screen version almost of himself that is swanning around in a suave, flying between places and he's working as a freaking potato farmer or something at that point.
Yeah.
You know, you look at people like Speer, and we mentioned Greta Sereni already, but her book on with him is fantastic as well. But the people who rationalize and remain useful, and I was fascinated by, for example, Speer as much, because his usefulness is almost being the one who says, yes, I'm guilty. And the moment he says, yes, I'm guilty, he becomes very useful to people, almost more useful to all the people who said they were not guilty.
Yeah.
You have been listening to the extra bit on the Untitled History Podcast. If what you have heard there is a thing you want to hear more of, then I'm sorry it faded out. But what you will have to do is back us, and then you can find out more. So don't forget to back us at theuntitled-history.com for more of what you've heard here and more extra episodes in future.